The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Good evening. My name is Shia Cohen, and it's a pleasure to welcome everyone here. I have to begin with two apologies. First apology is that I have to leave. Baruch Hashem, I have a simcha in the family, a personal simcha, a little bit unscheduled, so I have to get out of here. I won't have the privilege of hearing Dr. Pelkowitz. Second apology is that instead of just putting Dr. Pelkowitz up here, once I get up here to make the first apology, I can't resist just to say a few words. So you'll forgive me for just a few moments, and then we'll get right now to the program. I think that it's superfluous to tell you people, as individuals involved with mentoring, for the most part, I imagine, how important this really is. I remember the day many years ago when I first moved out to the West Coast, the San Fernando Valley, which had a reputation of being the end of the world as far as Yiddishkeit was concerned in the 70s. I moved out there. I'd spent many years in the Kollel, and I really thought that I could conquer the world. It took about 3 months. I brought out a small group of yeshiva bochrim. You know, they weren't even the most accomplished, although many years later they were highly accomplished. But at the time, young, and just came out, you know, to help out and to learn and to be mashpia a little bit. It took about 3 months, and I came to the realization that these guys had the kids eating out of the palms of their hands, and they left me someplace in the dirt. Like, you know, here's this guy who really thought he could turn anybody on to Yiddishkeit. And I learned then the lesson of the power of peer mentoring, that just someone who's maybe a few years older, maybe even a few more years older, but closer in age, not necessarily in the Rebbe relationship, more as a friend, has an entree to a person's neshama that I don't believe anybody else has. And I think certainly in terms of validating a person and making them feel good about themselves, there's nothing as powerful as that. I like to say, you know, that love validates. The Sipurno defines love as sheyismach oyhev b'malas haneahav, that the one who loves rejoices in the qualities. We love qualities. We love something about people. A parent who loves a child does a lot of validating, but it isn't the ultimate validation. Because what do you expect? You know, my mother loves me. It's like my grandmother loves me. Like, you know, tell me another one. Of course, if a parent doesn't show that love, that could be the most devastating thing. Because this is the one who genetically is supposed to love me, who's paid to love me, and doesn't seem to hold for me, and I'm really in trouble. But a mentor? Why? Why do you pay attention to me? Why should you be interested in helping me? Why should you befriend me? And that type of relationship can be the most validating relationship that exists and really make people feel good about themselves. And when kids feel good about themselves, many of their problems just disappear. I think that there's two other issues that should also be kept in mind just by way of introduction. One is Chazal tell us that the Klal Yisrael is compared to an olive. An olive has the most precious oil inside, but it's the most difficult to access. You have to beat and stomp and squeeze and stretch that olive until you finally get the oil out. And so too, Chazal say the Klal Yisrael, it's a Midrash Rabbah, I think, at the beginning of Parshas Tetzaveh. So too the Klal Yisrael, that they have this greatness inside. Everyone. But to access it, they have to go through difficulties and Yisurim and all types of suffering until it's finally accessed. And if Chazal compare the two, they must be absolutely comparable. And that means that just as the oil is not created by a chemical process when you squeeze, it's rather there to begin with. You just have to get it out. So too, this godlus that exists inside every Yiddish neshama is there. It's a reality. It doesn't have to be built. It's there. It just has to be accessed. I made this drosha many years ago. There was a Talmud of ours who was, I guess, touched by it in some way. He was an artist. He painted a big portrait that he brought me. And I guess it was from the face, the bottom, the smile and the beard. It must have been me. The beard was a little bit blacker in those days. And I was squeezing the oil out of an olive, and my eyes were covered with a talus. And somebody walked into the office after I had posted it up there and says, "Why? Why are your eyes covered?" I didn't know what he had in mind. I said, "You know, sometimes if you want to conceive that inner beauty, you have to close your eyes. And not only close your eyes, not to see what it looks like on the outside, but you have to cover them so you shouldn't peek. You can't peek. Don't look for a minute. And just conceive that inner beauty." Sometimes if we look at the outside, and I don't have to tell you people, you'll never guess. You'll never imagine. You couldn't believe what greatness lies inside. I think that's something that you people probably realize more than anyone else. And the fact that that greatness exists inside really means that you people are the perfect people to access it. Because it doesn't necessarily need, well, it does, but it certainly there's so much that can be accomplished even without the chinuch process, just by the camaraderie and the friendship and the guidance and the sharing and the loving and the caring. So I think this is, you're in an amazing position to be able to change the direction of people's lives. Just one more thought. I told you once you get up here, it's very hard. Dr. Pelvis doesn't have a problem. You can sit down. But once I get up here, it's very hard.
Thank you, sir.
That's very gracious of you. That's not what people are here for. Anyway, so just one more thing. When Moshe Rabbeinu was appointed as the manik, when Moshe Rabbeinu was told that he's dying and Yeshua's guest, and a new manik has to be appointed, so he had a tefillah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He asked for four things. The first thing he asked for was about Yemen Moshe El Hashem. And Rashi's bothered by this strange lashon of Elkeho Ruchos L'chol Boso. Yivkoid Hashem. So Rashi says that Moshe's tefillah went like this. Ribbono Shel Olam, you know that each and every individual is different. Appoint a manig sheyuchol lizvel das kol echod ve'echod. A manik who can tolerate. It's a sevel, it's tolerance, it's not easy. It's much easier to deal with everybody in one mold. But the manik of Klal Yisrael, not the parent of a family, not the teacher of a classroom, not even the menahel of a small, medium, or large yeshiva, but the manik of Klal Yisrael, a few million nefashos. The first item on the short list of his requirements has to be the ability to individualize and to tolerate each and everyone's individual differences. What could be more appropriate for a group of mentors than the realization of the importance of individualizing? You're dealing with people on an individual basis. You can achieve what no one else could possibly achieve in a group setting by that personal contact, by that love, by that caring. It works so far that I don't have to tell you that, you know, you have literally the power to change the direction of these people's lives. And Be'ezus Hashem, you should be matzliach. The reason that we're here this evening is that over the years in dealing with machanchim and hopefully now with mentors, we've come to the conclusion that even the best, need training. You know, I saw somebody wrote recently an article. He says, your barber needs to go to school and get a license. Your lawyer, kol shekein, you know, not to mention a doctor, of a mechanech, or even a mashpia, who's dealing with the most important investment that we have on this planet, doesn't necessarily have to have any training, doesn't have to necessarily have to have any preparation. You know, he wings it, and of course, there's a certain percentage that are just born into it. There's a certain percentage that probably shouldn't get started with it in the first place. But the bulk in the middle, if they're trained, if they're exposed to people who have experience and insights and a wealth of knowledge, then it can make all the difference. Well, I think we have that opportunity here this evening. Dr. Pelkowitz truly, truly needs no introduction. His reputation precedes him wherever he goes and wherever he doesn't go, and eventually they invite him over there too. His professional credentials are too much for me to remember. But he's well known in the world of chinuch as well as in the world of psychology as a master of the insights and understanding of what the teenagers today, what the children today, what they're all about, what their problems are, how to deal with them. He himself has, for many years, had a practice in dealing with problems of children and has done wonders for them. Wherever he speaks, the Olam walks away feeling that they've truly gotten practical, down-to-earth insights based on wisdom, experience, and everything that Dr. Pelkovitz brings to this. And I dare say the sensitivity and the caring, not just to help everybody like this, but to help each individual that constantly bothers him with their personal problems. By the way, my daughter wanted me to ask you if she can call you up about an issue. I mean it seriously, I forgot. But that's the way Dr. Pelkovitz lives. So it's truly an honor to have him. Again, I apologize for not being able to stay. I just ask that everybody here please sign in on this. We hope that this will be the first of many such sessions. We hope we'll be able to be in touch with you by email or phone or fax. So if you give us that information, then we'll make sure to follow up on that. Thank you very much. Call to.
Thank you, and mazel tov. Oh, wow. Okay. Everybody a mentor? Yeah? How many mentors here? Okay. Anybody else I should be targeting here? There's some Rebbeim I see, some people who have yeshivas reaching out to at-risk kids, right? Anything else I should know? Okay. What I'd like to do, I'm not sure exactly how to structure this in exactly the right way, but what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to do some words of introduction, just some basic concepts, but I think the way to make this most meaningful is to have it be an open discussion. Because another, you don't need to talk. You need tachless hands-on questions from the kids you might be working with. So let me start by, first of all, let me give you a little bit of background on what some of the current thinking is about what's effective and not effective in mentoring. Sorry for a couple of you, this is going to be feel like repetitive because we just had a similar session. But let me start with this. Very interesting. There have been three studies done about kids growing up on islands where they're under tremendous stress. They find islands because that's the purest form of research. And they follow them up from birth into adulthood. So one was done in the Hawaiian island of Kauai, which is a place where at the time, in 1955, they looked at every single kid born on the island. It was a place filled with tremendous abuse, tremendous maltreatment of children, and tremendous poverty. In spite of its incredible beauty, there was a corresponding horror to the lives of children born there in 1955. There have been similar studies done on the Isle of Wight off the coast of England, and then another done in the United States in Martha's Vineyard. And what they do in each of these studies is they follow up these at-risk populations from birth into adulthood, and they ask a simple question. What differentiates the kids who make it from the kids who don't, right? And it turns out, for example, in the Kauai study, which is probably one of the most famous studies, they're still being studied to this day. They're now 50 years old, right? So in the Kauai study, I'm going to go over the ingredients, and they pretty much are the same ingredients of the other two islands. And it's basically a third, a third, a third. Well-known fact in psychology, the answer to almost any large-scale study is a third, a third, a third. Okay, if you have a test on this stuff, just answer a third, a third, a third, you'll have the right answer. It's a good thing to know. What they found in the Kauai study was that a third of the kids were resilient in spite of the abuse, in spite of the difficulties in their lives in spite of the poverty, they made it. They were resilient. Psychologists call it the magic of the ordinary. Pretty high percentage to have made it. The other third were in the middle, and the final third succumbed to the ravages of the poverty and abuse. And what they look at is, what is it that differentiated the most resilient third from the least resilient third? What were the ingredients? If we could bottle it, we then know, okay, how do we help children at risk? How do we help children who are not doing so well? And guess what was the top of the list? I'm going to give you three things at the top of the list, and each of them have direct implications for the topic tonight. Number one was one person who cares. That's all it took, was one person who cares. If they had a one person, sometimes it was in the family, sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes it was a natural mentor who the kid recruited. But interestingly, and this is where some tachlis stuff starts to come in, the kids who were most likely to recruit the one person who cared, you were able to identify them in the baby nursery. So in this study in 1955, they went to the baby nursery of these kids. They were just like 4 or 5 days old. And they had independent raters rate them on a Chayn scale. Okay? They rated them on a Chayn scale. So on a scale of 1 to 10, they'd say, they didn't call it a Chayn scale, but it was like, how much Chayn does this person have? Okay? It turns out that those who were rated high in Chayn, they were babies that were just likable, they were lovable, were more likely to be in the resilient third, and they were the ones who were most effective in recruiting the one person who cared. Now, the question is that biology? Are we born with Chayn? Or can we teach people to have Chayn? Through the process of mentoring, as you become the one person who cares, as they feel loved and they feel cared for and they feel connected to, do they in turn develop the Chaynkeit that in turn becomes the major ingredient of resilience? Interesting question. But clearly, in this core ingredient, the core ingredient is one person who cares. One person who cares. It's that connection. Listen to this story, and then I'll go to the other two ingredients. There was a woman in my neck of the woods in Long Island. Very prominent mental health expert. Her name was Sadie Hochstein. Now she must be in her, she must be well into her 80s. But very charismatic woman. And she told us at a talk she gave in our area, Grand Rounds, at our hospital, incredible story. She trained with Anna Freud, one of the Gedolim of child psychology. She also was an actress. She had a show business background. But she'd become a social worker trained by Anna Freud. And she was a member, as many people were in the 1940s, of the British Army, of the women's part of the British Army, WAVES, I forget what they were called in the UK. And the war is coming to an end, and word comes out that 70 children had survived Bergen-Belsen, which was under British control. And they're looking for a house mother to take care of the children until they could figure out what would be done with them. And she hears about this, and she thinks to herself, she's a Jewish woman, she says, Ki l'kach notzarti, right? This is my thing. Now I know why I was put on this earth. What Jew could not have been devastated by hearing the realities of the camps? Here she's the young officer in the British Army, and she hears that she could put her maternal instincts and her mental health background to use in terms of taking care of the children of Bergen-Belsen. So she drives her commanding officer crazy. She says, look, I was trained by Anna Freud. I have the background. I'll take good care of them. They say, maybe not. You're so young. She drives them crazy. She's a very persistent, very persuasive woman. I could tell you because very often she's persuaded me to do things that I don't think I probably I never regretted it, but it was, she had me take on more than I probably should have in certain areas. Okay. She drives them crazy. And she goes there. She goes there. And you could only imagine, if you saw her back then, she was an incredibly attractive, charismatic woman. She'd been an actress. She was very, a lot of magnetism. And the kids fall in love with her. They hadn't had somebody treat them like a person in their years in the camp, and they had been through torture. And here you have this attractive, charismatic, loving woman. They immediately fall in love with her. Turns out they were there for a longer period of time than they should have been, because there was a big fight between Ben-Gurion and Churchill. They each wanted the kids to come to their country. Churchill wanted the propaganda value of having these 70 survivors come to England. It's probably the same time they weren't allowing people to come to Palestine. And Ben-Gurion obviously wanted the Jews to come home. Tremendous fight, and slept on for quite a bit of time. And she became the mother to these children. Word comes out that they're about to demobilize the American and British troops and send them home. So they asked her, because of her show business background, to the night before everybody pretty much was going home, to put on, to arrange like a USO/UKO show, okay? And they had the top comedians and actors of the time. They had Jack Benny, Bob Hope. We've read about the entertainment they'd have. These massive tens of thousands of troops just before they went back to Britain and to America. Now, you may have read, it was very dangerous then. There were still German snipers. Security had to be incredibly tight. The children of Bergen-Belsen hear that their Sadie was going to be in charge and emceeing this show. And they're incredibly excited. They go to her and they say, Sadie, we want great tickets. Get us the best tickets you could get us. And like a good mother, she said, no, it's past your bedtime. Show starts at 8 o'clock. It's 8 o'clock. You're going to sleep at 8 o'clock. So they drive her crazy. She says, absolutely not. Right? You have to know when the smoldocha, when the mimikarevas. She put up the smoldocha. She said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And they complain and complain and complain. But she does not give in. The night comes. You have to picture, you know, I've seen some pictures of what those kind of entertainment events were. Tens of thousands of troops with massive, massive security at every point. She goes up to the stage to introduce the first entertainer. And there, the front three rows are the 70 children of Bergen-Belsen. Screaming, Sadie, Sadie, you know, like cheering her, and she's beyond furious. She goes down, she kills the mic, she goes down, and she turns to the kids and she says, how did you get in? You let me know who let you in, because he's a dead man. He's a dead man. I told you, it's past your bedtime. How did you get here? And one of the kids looked at her, and they said to her, Sadie, we got through the last number of years in Bergen-Belsen. You don't think we could get past American and British security? Now, what happened to these children? We know what happened to these children. Because Anna Freud studied them, probably through the Sadie connection. She studied them. And other people studied them into adulthood. Same thing. We know that what psychologists called, as I said before, the magic of the ordinary is what prevailed. In spite of the fact that Anna Freud predicted that they'd be emotional basket cases, the vast majority of them had scars. You have scars from this kind of thing. You have scars from the trauma. You have scars from having been through the most horrible, horrible series of events ever suffered just about by anybody. But we also know that as long as they had one person who cares, Anna Freud's research showed, they made it. In spite of all predictions, they made it psychologically. Many of them did end up here and ended up having, Baruch Hashem, wonderful, productive lives. It doesn't mean that there wasn't a impact of what happened, but that's the one person who cares. Beautiful mashal from the Divna Magid. Many of you may have heard it, but too bad. I'm going to say it again. Okay? And it's what you keep in mind. We had an earlier discussion in a meeting earlier with mentors talking about this idea of the pain that your children often go back to, and how do you handle that? Listen to the Divna Magid. Again, it's a story forged in the suffering of Jews through the terrible years in Europe going back. The mashal is a king who has a diamond in the center of his crown. And the diamond is bigger than the Hope Diamond, right? Many of you have heard this story, but it's worth it. It's worth it. Many of you I see haven't, so I'll say it. I'll say it. Okay. Diamond is huge. It's an insecure king. And he gets a tremendous amount of feelings of strength from having the biggest and best in the land. And he wakes up one morning and he finds that a flaw has developed right down the center of the diamond. And he is spooked big time because he says this is a bad omen. This is not a good sign at all that here the symbol of my power has a flaw right down the middle. And he puts out a call to the kingdom. And he says, whoever can fix this flaw, I will make wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. And jewelers come from all over the world to try to fix the flaw. Nobody can fix the flaw. Flaw in a diamond is the flaw in the diamond. We can't undo the history of abuse that some children have, necessarily. We can't undo dysfunctional families, necessarily. We can't even undo some of the learning disabilities that leads to kids having problems. But here's what happens at the end of the story. Little old Chassid, see this story, it has to have a little old Chassid as the hero. So little old Chassid comes in, and he takes an engraving tool, and he engraves magnificent leaves around the floor that now become the center of a tree that makes the diamond even more beautiful than it was before. Okay? Nimshol is obvious. Nimshol is what you all do in terms of this ingredient number one is you connect. You connect. You connect to kids in a way that you may not even be aware of. We're going to talk about that. Just through the connection, you don't undo the flaw, but you help the child believe in others. You help the child maybe even develop a little bit of chen. You help the child get a model for a healthy relationship, and that takes the flaw that now becomes a center of strength. Many, many kids who have gone through tough times in life say, you know something, I've been through a lot, but I know what's important. When I become a father, when I become a mother, I'm going to parent differently. When I become an adult, I'm going to see to it that children aren't abused. When I become an adult and overcome my learning disability and get some training so I could be a certain kind of mechanech, I'm going to see to it that children who need a unique learning style are going to be reached out to and not be lost. So that's ingredient number one. Ingredient number one is your role as the one person who cares, your role as the chain maker. Okay? So that's number one. Ingredient number two in the longitudinal studies is interesting, and you know, we don't even need to talk about it, but I'll talk about it a little bit. And that's that it turns out that in Kauai, in the Isle of Wight, and in Martha's Vineyard, but certainly in Kauai, those with active religious beliefs were more likely to be in the resilient third. Okay? So if you came from a family that somehow connected you to spirituality, right? In their case, it was Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach. But it doesn't matter. What matters is if there's a sense of connection to what you guys are all connected to and what you women are connected to, that becomes the source of resilience. Why? The why I spoke about a little bit, those who heard me, Sunday night. How many of you heard me Sunday night? Oh, good. Only a handful. Okay. So, Chazara. It's anything that takes you, forget the Frumkeit part, anything that takes you from the passive to the active, that gives you a sense that I could do something. I could daven. I could say Tehillim. I could be connected, that I'm not just a log floating on the river at the mercy of the current, is going to be a key ingredient in resilience. So to the extent that a mentor brings connection as a role model of Frumkeit, that's the second ingredient in soul. It's a role model for integrity, a role model that you may not believe so much in the beauty of Yahadus, because of certain things that might have happened to you that makes you feel on the fringe. I can show you that through my idealism, I'm going to connect to you in a way that also connects you to the wisdom and meaning and active level of being a mentor. Very important. What I said Sunday night, I think, was beautiful Rosh Hashanah Rafal Hirsch on the Pasuk Kinesha Yarkina. Did I say that? Good, okay. Okay? It's Kinesha Yarkina Chazar. It's Chazar is good. Kinesha Yarkina is basically, he asks the question, why an eagle? Why are B'nai Yisrael in the time of Tzara compared to an eagle of all the birds or of all the animals? Why not to a lion or a tiger? Why not to, to some other animal? And he answers, because there's something unique about eagles that we don't see anywhere else in the animal kingdom. Every other animal, when its babies are in danger, the babies are in a passive role when they're saved. The mother bird swoops down on the baby and flies the chick to safety. An eagle, because it flies higher than any other bird in the sky, hovers around the nest while the baby bird, the baby eagle, hops on its back. And the mother flies off to safety. Because if somebody chooses to shoot an arrow at the eagle, at least the baby will be safe. So unlike any other creature, non-human creature, what we're taught by the beauty of Kinesha Yarkino is that the model is, in times of Tzara, you have to take an active role. And that's what that ingredient is. What that ingredient is the ingredient of meaning. Study after study after study about what this kid shows, that if they don't have meaning and connection to meaning, they're at greater risk for substance abuse. They fill in the void, the spiritual void that way. They're at greater risk for a whole host of difficulty, including emotional problems like depression. You need that connection. You need that hook. You need that hook. And that's what you provide just through being. I'm not saying through preaching to them or getting all frummed out on them or anything like that. Just by being with them and showing them who you are. There's no greater lesson than connecting to somebody through what Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky used to call shipua, right? To be a mashpia. He says, you're not mechachem, you're mashpiyim. And the word mashpia comes from the word shipua, which means a ramp. What you ramp down to these children that you're working with, to your mentees, what you ramp down without even realizing it, just by being with them, is being role models of from Jews who are there for them and care enough about them to not just connect to them, but to also show them what it is to be an integrated person who connects emotion and mind and who could serve a... for them is the sense of the way to be an integrated kind of Jew. No small thing. It's a beautiful Gemara on Rav Yossi, that on Shavuos he used to tell his servants, go prepare, what is it, what's the Lashon for Egel Shulash, right? What's the Lashon?
Egla Tilsa,
you know, the finest kind of meal. And he says, why on Shavuos did he go to such extra expense relative to the other regalim or other times? So they say, because if it wasn't for Torah, what would we say? Kama Yossi Ika B'shuka. It's not sackcloth or something like that. I'd be like any Joe in the street. I'd be like any Joe in the street, if you forgive the plain language, okay? So the Bali Musters say something very interesting. They say, what does it mean that I'd be like any Joe in the street? They say, Torah is integrating. Torah is the antidote to hypocrisy. You take the average Joe, and he's one person in the shuk. He's one person at work, he's one person at home, he's one person, b'chadrei chadarim. The word personality comes from the word persona, it comes from mask. A mask. The real person, though, the integrated person, is rarely without the power of Torah integrated. He says, I am the same Yossi, right? Be I in the Shuk, or be I in the Beis Medrash, or in the privacy of my home, or in Chadrei Chadarim. So if it wasn't for the Torah, I would not be an integrated person, right? Integrity, the word integrity comes from the word integer, comes to be whole. To be whole, to be a shalem. Now, it turns out that, as you know, the kids we work with have a real eye for the phony, a real ear for insincerity. And to the point that you could be role models of solidity for them, you're bringing in that second ingredient, the ingredient of meaning, the ingredient of being a role model, the ingredient of integrity, the ingredient of integrity. So that's number two. It's number two. It's the modeling from Kite through Shipua. So it's the one person who cares. It's the actively religious person. And the third and final, before I go on to figuring out what I'm going to say next, is interesting. And this is something I don't talk enough about, and I have to remember to talk about it. It's the issue of required helpfulness. And I'm going to say something that I don't think is going to be surprising to anybody. It's a lot of what you're doing here. Required helpfulness is the transformative power of taking children who are not feeling part of anything. They're not feeling connected. They're not feeling part of the kahila. That's why they wander away from us, or at risk for wandering away from us. And connecting them to chesed. In Kauai, kids who were told, you have to pitch in to help out the family, they were more likely to be in the resilient third. Now, this doesn't mean to overburden them. Overburdening is where they take the role of the mother or father who's not present, where they lose their adolescence to an absent parent or a parent who leans on them too much. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about required helpfulness is to make them belong, to give them the connection through connecting them to what really matters. You connect them to what really matters, you give them a chance to do chesed, either by helping other kids or by doing any one of a myriad of chesed projects, and it's transformative. I can't tell you how many kids I've seen who've been alienated, who when they get pulled into a soup kitchen or doing chesed by working with kids with Down syndrome or working with special needs kids or spending a summer in working in some place where they, let's say, are a shadow for a troubled kid or anything like that, it changes them. Why does it change them? Because it brings them right back into the kahila. Again, all that at-risk is about is not matching the bumper sticker of society. Okay, I've said this before. Some of you have heard it. I'll repeat it because it's the key point I want to make. And I really do want to get discussion going. And I'll bounce off your questions. But it's basically what at-risk is about is what all the research shows. And you know this. This is that it's kids who don't feel like they can belong to society. Now, sometimes just because the yeshivas kick them out too easily. The research shows that it's normative for kids to experiment a little bit, to the point that in studies in the secular world, they find the kids who just experiment a little bit, it's a normal part of what adolescents do for a living, and they actually, in the long run, are a little better adjusted than kids who never experiment at all. Obviously, there are different lines crossed in different places, but the key point here is that we have to figure out a way to get them into the kahila. That's the key. So what does the research show? Kids who are learning disabled, either because they have kriya problems, especially the research shows early on, so they don't feel part of the kahila that way. And often it's not discovered till later. I have a colleague who did an informal study here in Yerushalayim with kids on the street, girls on the street. And he asked them a simple question. He went through the list of risk factors that we know put kids at risk and asked them, A, how old were you when you knew you had this problem? B, how old were you before any adult in your life knew you had this problem? And on average, or Shimon Russell found, was that it was at least 4 years before the average kid had their problem known to adults in their life. So they suffered silently. I told the group before what always goes ringing in my ear. My Rebbe Rav Palm, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, used to tell us over and over again. I had this close of having him as my Rebbe for 4 years in a row. Our shir, as he was being promoted through the system at Torah Vadas many years ago, our shir happened to be the lucky shir that grabbed him by the coattails all the way through those years. And he used to tell us, if you see an abused child or a suffering child and you look the other way, he said, you're over on the lav of the Hisalamta Mehem. It's Halama, the lav of Halama. And you know what? Psychologically, we're always in danger of doing that. We're in danger of looking the other way. I heard a story just today about a situation of a child who was being sexually abused, an incredibly, incredibly promising Talmud Chacham. He told the Mashgiach of his yeshiva that he was being sexually abused, and the Mashgiach said, that doesn't happen in this yeshiva. And the child was lost. Today he doesn't even have a shred of Frumkeit. Doesn't even have a shred of connection. That was enough. He was a very spiritual kid, and it hit his neshama. He had a very sensitive neshama. It hit him where it hurts. Okay? We've all heard stories about that. An inordinate number of these kids have been abused. Inordinate. I see it over and over again. A day doesn't go by that I don't get a call related to it, either of abuse here or in the United States. It's changing a little, at least in the United States, under the threat of lawsuits, but it has a long way to go. Why does abuse lead to that? Because if you're abused, you see hypocrisy. How could people who are supposed to protect you allow that to go on? How do you account for that lack of integrity? And then we have kids who don't match the bumper sticker of their families, okay? Again, those of you who've heard me speak before knows it's one of my favorite topics. There's different families have bumper stickers. Some families, it's Lakewood or die. Other families, it's Harvard or else. Other families, it's be a Baal Chesed or a Baal Tzedakah, or you're finished, okay? Now, if that's your family bumper sticker, and your netiyah is opposite that, so you have an attention deficit, so you can't learn in the mirror. Or you have a kind of style that makes it hard for you to let go of yourself when you're an adolescent, and you're not ready for that. Or somehow you don't match your parents' dream, it becomes very problematic. Beautiful thought on the Mosjikna Shalavid Rab Chalon. Beautiful thought I heard. I wish I could say it over in the proper name. The person who told it over to me had heard it and doesn't remember where. But it's a beautiful thought. The thought was, what was it that Yosef saw when he sees his father's image reflected back at him when he was being tempted to sin with Eishes Potiphar? It says what he saw was his father's expectations of him. So much of what a child does, here Yosef was an adolescent, right? So much of what an adolescent does is based on the expectations of a parent. Either reflected appraisals of the parent is believing in the kid, you're going to go very far. Right? How can I disappoint my father? My father taught me, in this case, Hakara Setov. As we know that Yaakov was the expert in Hakara Setov. He was the first one to build mikneh for cattle, the sukkos for cattle. And he, in general, even in terms of sending Yosef out to check on the animals, he had a special sensitivity to Hakara Setov. So what expectation did Yosef, according to many Mefarshim, reflect back? It was, how could you be a kafoi tov to Potiphar who took you in off the street and gave you a wonderful job and a comfortable home? And that's what he saw. That was the expectation. And he matched it. But what happens if the mirrors reflected back to you are not expectations that are positive, but are expectations of the negative and make you feel like you don't belong? Then you're in big trouble. So that is very much the third ingredient. So the third ingredient is what pulls you back. What pulls you back in? What pulls you back in is anything that makes you feel again to be part of the kehillah. Okay? Let me tell you a quick bumper sticker story. Okay? Story goes like this. Story of the bumper sticker. Um, And maybe with this I'll end it and bring it to a conversation, because I really do want to get that going. Yeah, good story. Story of a young man comes to see me. He was walking down his Rosh Yeshiva. You talk about bad luck. Good kid, but not great judgment. And he goes to a place where problematic kids are known to hang out. And he was probably experimenting a little bit. And he decides to experiment a little bit with some marijuana. He goes to a real yeshivish place. And just his luck, his Rosh Yeshiva is passing by, doing some shopping in that area. He sees him on the stairwell, whiffs it, knows what it is, kicks him out of yeshiva. Nobody knows about it. So his parents call me. They say, look, nobody knows about it. Let's see what we could do, because it's going to destroy him. They came from a very yeshivish family. The bumper sticker was, finest yeshiva or else, and here he's being kicked out in high school. So I call the Rosh Yeshiva. I say, look, nobody knows. I'll make you a deal. I'll fax you a drug test once a month, showing that he's clean. And I'll call in a psychotherapy summary to you about how he's doing and how he's cooperating once a week. You have nothing to lose. If he's not making progress, then you could kick him out. But otherwise, I'll continue to see him and I'll supervise him. I give you my word. And I had a relationship with this Rav. And he said, okay. He was reluctant, but he said okay. Because he had nothing to lose. It wasn't like the reputation of the yeshiva was going to go down the tubes. Nobody knew about it. We were lucky. And I see the kid, and the kid's really coming. He's connecting. He's not using drugs anymore. He's testing clean. And as I see him, though, I see that this is one of the kids whose bumper sticker was, the family bumper sticker was learning 24/7. And he had a learning disability, he had an attention deficit, he had terrible abstract thinking skills. He was incredibly street smart. He had a chush for business. He had a chush for being, he knew he was the street smart kid. He knew what to do. But he just couldn't, he had no head for learning. He had no situation, he just couldn't get it. He couldn't learn the simplest Gemara. And he was despondent, because what he saw reflected back in the eyes of his parents was constant disappointment. They weren't so unsophisticated that they told him, but he knew it, he felt it. The role models he was constantly surrounded with were older siblings who were stars in leading yeshivas. So I asked him, finally, I said, who really gets you? You know, we talked on Sunday night about the beautiful description of, among others, I think, Rav Shamsher Fall Hirsch on Ish Asher Kevirchaso Berachasan, that what's the nature of the bracha? If you look at the brachas, they're not really brachas that Yaakov gave. They're descriptions. It's the Ashrei Yishur that we talked about, right? It's description. That's what's validating. When somebody gets you, that's the biggest bracha. They didn't get him. They didn't accept him, and he felt marginalized. He was beginning to find acceptance in more similarly marginalized peers. So I said, who gets you? He says, my grandfather. I said, fine. I said, your grandfather gets you. Maybe we could get some movement here in terms of helping out. If your grandfather gets you, maybe he could help your parents get you. So I got his permission to have a session of the grandfather, the mother, and the father. And the kid. We sit in my office. Grandfather didn't know anything. I told him what happened. I had permission to tell him. And he was the guy who ran the business. Big, very successful business that was supporting all the boys learning, all the sons-in-law learning. He was the money bags. Very successful guy. Very big business. And he hears the story, and he immediately turns red, furious. He turns to his son, father of this boy, and he says, don't you know who you are? Don't you know why this family exists? He says, because of a neshama like his. And he turns to his grandson and he says, let me tell you about our story. Maybe you don't know it. He said, I was exactly your age when in Europe I saw what was happening. I also had siblings who were learning. I also, though, felt that we were all going to get killed if we stayed. They were all in Europe, and they were basically had Hitler closing in on them. So he said, I begged my parents, let's get out of here. They're going to kill us all. And he said, my parents, he said, if they believed in psychologists back then, they would have schlepped me to somebody like this. And he like gives me a look, a little stuck. You know? Okay. I could take it. Okay. So he said, you know what happened? With tears in his eyes, he says, you know what happened? He said, every one of them killed. He said, my mother, my father, my brothers, my sisters-in-law, my nephews, my nieces, not a single survivor except me. I saw what was happening. I ran away from home. I managed to get myself to America in the nick of time. And I started the business, which is supporting all of you. Because I'm street smart like he is. And he said, he points to his grandson. He says, if you can't make, he tells his son and daughter-in-law, if you can't make room for this neshama in your hearts, I don't have anything to do with any of you. And he leaves, he slams the door, and walks off. I never see him again. Never saw him again. There was a stunned silence in the room. And the daughter started to cry, the son started to cry, the grandson started to cry. And it was the turning point. Sometimes you have a turning point, you know? And they got it. They got this kid, okay? They got it. They made room. They expanded their bumper sticker. Today, he's running the business, and all of his siblings are working for him. It's the end of the story. Okay. He also, by the way, is a big supporter of many yeshivas. Okay, I wish I could tell names, but it's the best stories. I can't tell you the true story because I have to predict confidentiality. Okay, so let's pull it together and then let's get discussion going. So let's pull it together. Three ingredients in the three island studies are the following. Chen, right? There's no mystery as to why there is. What's the first thing we say in Berachas Kohanim every morning after your basic spiritual needs and safety is met? It's v'chuneka. There's something about chen, but through the connection and the one person who cares in that first ingredient, you, I think, could inject chen and the makings of chen, the makings of connection, because you could be a role model for the kids in terms of that part of ingredients. Number two is the ingredient of creating meaning. The actively religious kids on those islands were more likely to be in the resilient third. The eagle flying with the baby eagle on its back, going from passive to active and creating meaning, giving a sense of coherence and a sense of integrity as in being, not just like any Joe in the street, being a role model religiously for kids with the integrity that comes from that and something that kids could really believe in. And finally, required helpfulness is to figure out a way to get the kids outside of themselves, to get them into a world of maybe doing chesed and that being a back door maybe into belonging. Let me end with one final story, which really gets to the heart of this story. Many of you may have heard, but I have to say it over. It's a great story. Story that is a story I heard in a Talmud Torah convention a few years back. Story of principal of a high school here, from Masifta here. There was a boy who was problematic, really, really problematic. And the principal felt he had to kick the kid out, but he didn't want to do it. This is a number of years back. He didn't want to do it without asking his child. So he goes to Bonavich, and he goes to Rav Shach. And he goes to Rav Shach, he says, lays out the facts, and says, tell me, can I keep the kid, or do I have to throw him out? Is he a rodeo for now? Rav Shach said, no doubt, he's a rodeo if you have to throw him out. Okay, that's it. 6 months later, the same principal of the high school has to go back to Rav Shach for a totally different question. He goes back to Panovich, goes to wait outside Rav Shach's office. He's kept waiting for a very long period of time. Inordinately, he's not used to waiting so long to ask him a shiloh. He waits. Maybe an hour later, out of the office comes Rav Shach, Gemara under his arm, and the other arm around the boy who was kicked out. So the principal says, what's happening here? What's this about? So Rav Shach looks at him and says, well, somebody has to learn with him. Okay? Great story. And that's the ultimate lesson. The ultimate lesson is what you all do as mentors is you connect in a way that makes them feel like they belong. But that's not an empty thing, that connection. That's at the heart of what it takes to bring them back in to a sense of belonging, which they all desperately want. Every adolescent wants to belong to their family. Every adolescent wants to belong to their kahila. It's very painful not to. I don't know of a single adolescent who won't say immediately yes to the question, if I gave you a pill that would make you normal tomorrow morning and part of everything, would you take it? And they said, they all say in a heartbeat. And you become the vehicle for doing that. It's an incredible, incredible source. So let me open this to questions, and let's hear some tachlis questions from you. Yeah, please.
We went to a similar evening a couple of years ago here about what to do when your children become non-religious. And Rebbe Gilchrist basically gave the approach of you that they really just need to be loved and everything will be all right. Aviva Kamen, another psychologist, and a good one, felt differently. There's a certain lack of respect when you treat someone as though there's no respect to their doubts, to the religious doubts and so forth, and that you just assume they're emotionally deprived. Can you conceive of some of these kids being perfectly okay emotionally with their families? And their issues are intellectual and philosophical concern with religion, lack of faith, lack of belief, and to be addressed as such.
Such an interesting question. Yeah, let me repeat the question because it's fascinating. I never had that question before. Good question. The question is, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Maybe, in fact, that's interesting because I just came across some secular literature on the role of doubt in at-risk adolescence, religious doubt in at-risk adolescence, and I just arranged to get a book written on the topic. So just this morning, it's funny that you should ask it. So I wish I had read the book so I could really answer you. But the question is, maybe it's just a matter of doubt. Maybe it's just a matter of real cognitive intellectual doubt. Okay? Excellent question. My answer is, and I don't really know the answer in perfect, I do know some literature that'll tell me, is that I frankly have never seen a kid whose doubts aren't connected, whose matters of the mind aren't connected to matters of the heart. In other words, almost always, the Bein Adam L'Makom and Bein Adam L'Chavero are inextricably intertwined. So that, in fact, the research shows that. The research shows that if you have a good, solid attachment to either your family or to other kinds of mentors, the likelihood is, early on, actually I just came across this, age 13, 14, a good solid attachment, let's say, to parents, will predict, they use the word integrated in this literature, an integrated sense of emunah by young adulthood, but maybe a period of doubt in late adolescence. So your question is there ever a intellectual doubt not tied to some kind of emotional lack of connection? As I think about it, I can't think of any experiences I've had. Now, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, where I've seen it. I mean, so I think about it, there's one kid that's running through my mind, very bright, intellectual kid who became an incredible expert in the opposite of Dama Lahashavapikaris. Came from a frum family, and he knew what to answer every rav on any, he could answer anything. Came, he really studied philosophy at the highest level, theology at a high level, and whatever that means, and was able to counteract everything. And at first I thought he seemed to come from a loving family, but the more I came to know the family, the more I saw that the lack of connection to his frumkeit was very tied to a lack of connection to both his parents. So they didn't really get him. Now, I still have hope for him down the road. I'll say one thing to you, and that's that my colleagues and I have often said this. We have never seen in our careers, doesn't mean it doesn't exist, a kid who doesn't in some way come back eventually as long as there's a strong kesher with either one family member or somebody else in the community. I'll tell you an almost mystical story, because it happened to me last year. I was in California. I probably shouldn't have said that. Okay, I was out of the New York area. Okay. And I was asked to be speak at a shul Shabbos morning. And you have to understand, when I was growing up, it was a very different world. I grew up in Far Rockaway, New York, very different place back then. But it was also a much less complicated place. It was much easier to belong to everybody's bumper sticker. So once, you know, you may have rebelled, nobody noticed. Things, you know, sort of grew up. Almost all the kids in my classes growing up with, remained from. Didn't matter. I mean, I started by going, the only place around from was a place called Highlight, which is today Hafter, a very modern school. Then I went to Masifta of Long Beach, Charvet Das. But our whole cohort, our whole group of kids were pretty much, almost all of them stayed from. Two kids from my childhood class left. They left. And they were always a story. It was a very sad story. One of them, the word was he got intermarried. The other was that nobody really knew what happened to him. It was two kids in the whole group. Probably not bad when you look at overall percentages and numbers. So Friday morning, Shabbos morning, I was a scholar in residence in this shul. And all of a sudden, I catch out of the corner of my eye one of these two guys. I hadn't seen him in 30 years, or maybe even more, okay? Probably more like 35 years, okay? And I turned to the guy who's hosting me for Shas. I said, is that so-and-so? I just named the name of the guy. And he says, oh, yeah, how do you know him? And then I see two little kids running in, big yarmulkes on. And I say, I just know him from my childhood. So I go over to the guy after davening, and I say, what are you doing here? What's happening? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, right, I know I was the bad boy story of our childhood. He said, you know, it wasn't for me. I married somebody who wasn't Jewish. We just never connected. He says, now I found a nice Jewish girl. The kids are all going to yeshiva, and I'm back. He said, I'm back. Okay? So how did it happen? He said, I'll never forget this answer. He said, my father never stopped holding my hand. Great imagery. Said, my father never stopped holding my hand. Now, I'm not talking about this. He married a non-Jew, and obviously we don't necessarily, from a halakhic standpoint, it's a whole other thing. But that's what he said. Okay, fine. Next morning, Sunday morning, I was giving a talk in a local day school, local yeshiva there. And I'm getting up to talk. This is the strangest thing. And I look around, and there's in the back is the second guy from my childhood. Yeah, big yarmulke, sitting next to a woman with her head covered. And I said, oh, wow, okay. So I can't even concentrate on my talk. I'm thinking, like, this is some kind of simon, so I could answer this question in Yerushalayim a year or so later. So I go over to him. I said, what are you doing here? He said, you know, I finally found my way, and I finally got married, and I'm very happy, and I have these children. They're going to this yeshiva. So I said, what happened? What brought you back? He said, my mother never gave up on me. Just never gave up on me. We stayed connected. Now, my colleagues say the same thing. They say that somehow, as long as, it doesn't mean you don't disapprove. And it doesn't mean that maybe you don't even try to answer it at the level of philosophy and try to... Sometimes I do see kids who are intellectually brought back. But the answer usually is the answer of continuing to metaphorically hold their hand. Now, that doesn't answer your question completely. I think there probably are kids who intellectually... You know, let me answer that using a different prism. The other prism is the prism of formal operations. What does that mean? It means that Piaget tells us that when you hit adolescence, you get into a period of time where for the first time you could think abstractly. David Elkin, the big expert on religious development, calls it thinking in a new key. You could think at an abstract level. That's why, what is it, Ben Chamesh Esrei LeTalmud, right? And as we can't really learn at a high enough level to really match the intricacies of the abstract thought of Rishonim, Achronim, or even Basic Gemara, you can't really do it until you're 15, which about coincides with what Piaget says, formal operations. It's high levels of abstract thinking. Now, we all know, I'm here, I was visiting my grandson, my 2.5-year-old grandson, and he's drunk now with climbing. He's into climbing. That's what he's up to. That's what he does for a living. You let him loose, and he's discovered you could climb to high places. You could get to things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to get to. And that's what he does for a living. It's like you let him go. That's what he's up to. He's up to climbing. When I was here a few months ago, he was into something else, you know. Last year, he was into walking. You know, he was into whatever it is, but that was the center of his existence. What happens to adolescents when they hit formal operations? What they're drunk with is being able for the first time to evaluate thoughts and thinking and religion from an independent place. Some of them become more firm than their parents. Others come up with different variations on the theme of challenging the existing order. And some of them develop an intellectually based doubts about emunah. But I guess what I'm answering you is that, okay, that's a temporary phase. If you stay connected to the kid and let them maybe doubt and question while at the same time answering them, they will come back eventually as long as you keep holding their hand. So that would be my take on it. Very long-winded answer, but that's what I tend to give. You were going to ask something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many kids when you're dealing with them, you're 12 or 11 years old, they don't really know how to express what's going on with them. I just want to know, what are the signs, warning signs, basically? Like, what you should look for
is
something.
Right. You mean, if a kid, so the question is, if a kid is 10, 12 years old, what are some pre-risk warning signs? Okay. Let me start by answering your question with Garbarino, and then I'll give you a source, okay? Garbarino. Jim Garbarino is a professor of psychology at Cornell University in upstate New York. And he did a fascinating study a number of years ago. I never published it, but I heard about it from him. We've collaborated on some stuff, and I heard about it in a speech he gave in New York City once. And it goes like this. His theory was kids will hit up against wherever you draw the line for them. So the content depends on the culture. So in this study, this was during the height of the, well, I'll start it differently. He went to Amish countries, maybe 20, 25 years ago. I forgot exactly how long ago. When was the first Lebanese war? The Civil War? 1982. So, okay, about 25 years. Yeah, 24 years. 25. Okay. So, he wants to see what does adolescent rebellion look like in Amish countries. The Amish are these very firm kids who don't even ride tractors. They don't ride cars. No modern things. No electricity. Very Haredi type kids. Okay. Interesting. By the way, if you want a fascinating insight into religious development in adolescence. There's something called Rumspringa. Rumspringa is at age 16, in most Amish communities, kids are told, you're on your own now, you could do whatever you want, just get it out of your system. It's before they allow themselves to be baptized. They're told, go run wild. Go run wild. Do whatever you want. No rules whatsoever until you're ready to come back and accept for the rest of your life the strictures of our religion. And it's a fascinating, fascinating process because they do go run wild. Many of them run wild for 2 years, 3 years. They get into drugs, unrestricted sexual activity. They just go nuts. They really go nuts. The vast majority of them come back, the overwhelming majority. They have a very high retention rate. The problem is there are terrible problems with what they do relative to what we do with our kids. Terrible problems. And when you look at it in a little more sophisticated way, it's a whole other thing, but I won't talk about it. Rumspringa is fascinating. It's exactly the way Yahadus differs in terms of Chinuch Habanim, huh?
They're going, the damage they do themselves.
Oh, horrible damage, and it's just based on non-integrity. They also don't want the kids to question, so they stop teaching them any education, including religious education, at age 13. That's the end of it.
Damage themselves. sometimes has more problems than a goy because the level of damage and not damage.
Right, right, sure, sure, yeah.
All different scales.
Right, so it's fascinating, but listen to this. Listen to this. So it's he wants to see what does adolescent rebellion look like in Amish country. So what does he do? He goes and he asks the kids, tell us about any juvenile delinquents. You have rebellion in your society. He's interviewing these. It's chul Hashem. They don't want to tell him too much. So finally, he says, come on, tell me. It's okay. So finally, one kid says, okay, you know what? We'll tell you the truth. We have there's some kids who a few years ago put a pink handkerchief in their suit jacket. He said, okay, that's pretty bad. Okay. He said, but we want to know the absolute worst you ever had. The worst. I want to know the ultimate rebellion. So they don't want to tell them. They finally say, look, it wasn't our town. It's a different Amish town down the road. But there was a rumor once that a kid, one of our teenagers, hitched a ride on a tractor. Okay? That's the ultimate in rebellion. As part of the same study, he was looking at adolescent rebellion in different cultures. He went to Lebanon in the height of the war in 82. And there, the only way to rebel in the parts that he interviewed the kids was to open fire on your own clan. Okay? So what's the answer? The answer is it depends. One of my colleagues is doing a study on how adolescent rebellion looks different in the Hasidic world, how does it look differently in the Yeshivish world, et cetera, the more modern world. And it's totally different. So the answer now, Nefesh, you know, the International Organization for Mental Health Professionals, did put out a book on at-risk kids. It's worth getting if you do work in this because they have a whole section on mentoring in the last edition. And it's based on, they take 80 experts, rabbanim, psychologists, psychiatrists, mechanchim. They lock them in a hotel for 2 days. They just have us work on different components of that risk problem. And then a book comes out of it, a little book. It's about this thick by now. They've already done it 3 or 4 times. The final edition is about to get out, nefesh.org. You could order it through there, I think. But basically, they have guidelines in answer to your question. So they say, okay, what does pre-risk look like? And the answer is they have it for Hasidic kids. But they made it up, and it's probably different because it was written 5 years ago. So the beginnings are, so the answer is like any answer of psychology, it depends. So for some kids, pre-risk might be something subtle. It might be... Oh, you're talking about early risk. Okay, the Nefesh Manual actually has a whole section on early... Okay, on early identification. So at the behavioral level, it's anything that deviates from the norm, even a little bit. It might be interest in music has changed. It might even be something as simple as the angle or type of yarmulke. It might be dress, subtle stuff. It depends. It's where you draw the line, like Arborino would say. Personality-wise, what you look for is temperament. That is a red kind of temperament, meaning a temperament that's sort of frontal, they call. Today it's called frontal, meaning frontal, prefrontal connections, oppositional and defiant stuff. So it's kids who have this style have low frustration tolerance. They're wired in a way. They're more likely to be oppositional, more likely to be defiant, they're more likely to externalize blame. They're more likely to be subtly defiant. And if that's what's dominating, and again, the Nefesh book has this all laid out very carefully, then that's a red flag. We have yellow flags and red flags and white flags. And the red flags you have to take very seriously if you see it in a 10 to 12-year-old. So, you know, the earlier you get it, the better. We have a whole checklist to answer your question that we develop based on the literature and experience in the from community. And I suggest, especially if you're doing mentoring and you're trying to figure out which kids... And obviously, we know the earlier you mentor a kid, the better. If you want to look at that, you start doing it at that early age. So that makes sense. Yeah?
What would you say about when you have a connection with a child and you feel the connection is very strong, but the kid is doing things that are... It's hard for you to feel you can change. How do you look the other way? Or what's the limits of what you can tell a child and do for a child that will bring them to better, more positive behaviors?
Yeah, so you're saying you're connecting, but the kid doesn't seem to be changing. And Yeah, it's a tough question. So the question is really one of, are you doing the kid any favor if you know the kid is doing all kinds of risky stuff? They'll be doing it without you probably even more, but with you, they're still doing it. So it doesn't, the kesher. By the way, I'll tell you a quick story that I said earlier, so again, with apologies. And there's a method to my madness, okay? And it goes like this. It's called the sleeper effect. A colleague of mine, very respected psychiatrist, specializes in anorectics. And he tells the story of the worst session of his career. He was fresh out of medical school, fresh out of his residency, and he was seeing one of the first cases that he ever saw alone. It was in his practice. And it was a young anorectic woman, a teenager, I think about 15 years old or something. And it was out of control, the session, out of control. From the beginning to the end, it was 45 minutes, he said, of torture, because the parents start screaming at her, the siblings start screaming at her, she doesn't say a word, he's overwhelmed, he should have ended the session, he doesn't, he's just paralyzed. And nonstop 45 minutes of screaming at her and abusing her, session ends, of course she refuses to ever come back, and he feels terrible. 15 years later, he's walking down the street in Manhattan. I think it's something like 15 years later. And he sees her. Calls her over. He says, "Whoa, I'm so glad I saw you. I've had an apology stuck in my throat for the last 15 years. And she recognizes him. He recognizes her. And she said, "You mean for the session that saved my life?" He says, "What are you talking about? For the session that saved my life?" He says, "What are you talking about?" She says, "Follow." She says, "Look." She says, "You clearly had no idea what you were doing." Okay? She said, "You were just sitting there. You didn't say anything." She says, "Don't you remember what happened at the very end of the session?" She says, "I spent the session in the corner of your office with my coat over my head. And you just got up, gave a big sigh, and you said one thing. You said, 'My money is on that dark horse sitting in the corner.'" And she says, "That's what got me through the rest of my adolescence. Then in 45 minutes, you could see that they're all crazy and maybe I have something good going for me." That's my mantra. You know, my money is on that dark horse sitting in the corner. Now, I can tell you many other stories, okay, about sleeper effect, where you do something and it shows itself years later. Now, my belief is even though all you're doing with that kid is you mimic haravis, and the kid needs a small dog, the kid needs the limit setting, but you can't do it, either because he won't listen or because you just, you know, maybe you could try. I don't think you should give up trying, but you have to do it in a non-preachy way that he could hopefully, you know, hear you. But very often, you have your impact without even knowing it. So unless you feel that he's getting chizuk for doing bad stuff from your connection, I would just stay in there. You continue to let him know that you know one day he'll be better. You continue to reflect back in your eyes your expectations of something better. And maybe one day it'll start to hit. Classic psychology study. Clever hands. Some of you may have learned this study. Great study. One of the classic all-time studies in the history of psychology. Genius horse, I think it was in the 1920s in the United States, a math genius. Word gets out that a farmer out in the Midwest of the United States has a horse that you could ask it any math problem. It'll get it right 100% of the time. Math genius. People can't figure it out. They think it's a charlatan. But the farmer's not making any money off it. The farmer is not very happy. Huh? No, I'm sorry. The horse beats out with his hooves the exact answer. The question could be 4,926 divided by 13, the square root, etc. And it will patiently beat out exactly the answer and stop. If the answer is 340, it would hit its feet 340 times and stop. Nobody could figure it out. people say, okay, maybe some horses are math geniuses, who knows? So some psychologist, a guy named Ebbinghaus, I believe, goes and he decides that he's going to either prove the farmer a charlatan or he's going to figure out the mystery of the horse that's a math genius. So he goes and he does some investigating, and here's what he finds out. He finds out the horse is a math genius unless you put a screen between the questioner and the horse. Okay? When you put a screen between the questioner and the horse turns into a special needs math student. Gets wrong answers all the time, 100% of the time. Why? Because what was the horse a genius at, as many horses are? It was a genius at reading the expectations with a raised eyebrow or a slight change in breath when you hit the right answer. So the right answer was 23. When the horse hit 23, it would see that you knew that the answer was 23, and maybe your eyes would change a little bit. It's all about expectations, like the gifted class teacher given a gifted class, even though the class had average IQ, is told you have the gifted class, and by the end of the year, the class and the Pygmalion in the classroom study has significantly higher IQs and significantly higher test scores. Same class, just the teacher expected that they were gifted, so they acted gifted. Expectations are a lot. So that's what you can do. You connect through the expectations, and you connect in a way that makes clear to the kid that you expect better. Again, like the Mosyuk Nashalav of Rabbi Chalon, right? That's the expectations. Yosef, my Yosef, sin? Impossible. I would never expect that of him. That's the idea. So when you see that, eventually, hopefully, it'll take hold. Okay? I mean, I hope that's the right answer. Yeah.
What was it about a younger kid, 10, 11, 12, that you discussed before?
With what?
With a younger kid where there's not a lot of, there are signs of risk.
Okay, so again, look, there's only so much you could do, and sometimes the work really needs to be done with the parents, maybe by a professional or whatever, by a therapist. But with a younger kid, first of all, there's a lot that could be done maybe by helping parents when you get them that young. But on top of that, there's also, I'd say the same answer. So the same answer, you know. Look, the younger a kid starts with drug abuse or the younger a kid starts with at-risk behavior, the worse the prognosis. So there, you may not be the shliach for the small docha, but to the extent that you could get authorities to really intervene strongly, it's a worthwhile battleground with the younger kid, you know, because the kid is likely, you know, you might be able to just change the trajectory of their lives. So that's when they're missing up. It's probably a very troubled family, possibly. I don't know, but it's something that you need to look at. Yeah?
When you're working with a child or a teenager, and you know a lot, you have a relationship with him, and you're working with him, and he also has a relationship with another, say, the Mashkiach or another Rebbe or a Lisa. So how much, a lot of things, when you're working through something with him, and you find out information from other people that happened to him, or the abuse, or whatever it may be. So how much can you use from outside information that he doesn't even know you know? I mean, it's a really sensitive subject, you know, what you find out from others when you share it, and using that for the kid himself. How much you have to hear from him himself?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I know what to answer. In a psychotherapeutic setting, I would actually, if I wouldn't be betraying any confidences, I would actually directly use that as a trigger, because I'm not playing games with the kid, and I'm not, in other words, like I would say, hey, look, and I'm so concerned, I heard this, I might do it, I'm not sure. I would prefer that it come from the kid and come from trust. It's always better if the kid is expressing himself or herself from trust in the relationship. It's going to be much more powerful. I was talking in some other settings this week about naming the monster, the power. The refuah comes from talking it out. And that has to be done by the person. Another person can't do it for you. You know, so it's better if they tell you. But if you find them not telling you and you're stuck and you know it, it might be helpful to... You have to be careful, though, because sometimes I find that a kid will bolt if you do it too soon. So I would err, the kid's connected to you, and I would err on the side of not saying, of not letting them know that you know, and hope that they'll share it with you. Maybe you could steer the conversation in that direction. I find the kids usually tell, but it may take a long time. It's very, It's very painful because you know what it is. You want them to be able to talk about it. But usually you could steer it in that direction, I think. That's a good question. I don't know what else to say.
But you do find it helpful to get the information from the therapist in order to fish for it?
It could be. It could be. Because I think that otherwise it may never come out. And if it could come out to you also, you could be an incredible help them. There's a guy named Pennebaker who's done some fascinating research. I'm going to apologize ahead of time. I'm out to catch a flight, so unfortunately, tonight. So I have a cab waiting outside at 9. So I'm going to have to run out. And I know this cab driver is strict. He only believes in the small docha. So anyway, Pennebaker. It's an interesting point because it's related to this. Pennebaker is a famous psychologist. Did unbelievable research that at first nobody could believe because it's so bizarre. But then it's been replicated dozens and dozens of times. What he did was, about 15, 20 years ago, he had a couple hundred psychology undergraduates divided into two. Half wrote about the worst thing that ever happened to them 20 minutes a day, 3 days in a row. The other half wrote about their dormitory room in nauseating detail, 20 minutes a day, 3 days in a row. He then follows them through the 4 years of their college career and finds that the ones that wrote about the worst thing that ever happened to them got sick much less than other kids. They used University Health Service much less and also had slightly higher GPAs, grade point averages. So people say, that's silly. That's shrinky stuff. No way it'll hold up. They've done it so many times. I have a book at home this thick of Pennebaker's study. Somebody is Talmidim. One of them, published in one of the leading medical journals, the Journal of the American Medical Association, a couple of years ago, takes a group of 200 people with ulcerative colitis and rheumatoid arthritis, divides them in two. Half are asked to write about the worst thing that ever happened to them, 20 minutes a day, 3 days in a row. The other half are asked to write about their daily schedules, 20 minutes a day, 3 days in a row, in nauseating detail. 4 months later, they measured the severity of the illness, of the colitis and arthritis, and found that the group that wrote about the worst thing that ever happened to them were improved to a statistically significant effect. Basically, that not that they were totally cured, but they were significantly better relative to the comparison group. It's been done with unemployed people, get a job quicker when they write about the worst thing that ever happened. Now, what's that about? It's about the pshat in Bagav Levish, Yashchenas, Yasichena Lacherim, Machlokos Nirvami Nirvasi. The Yasichena Lacherim, talking it out, the connecting, and unburdening seems to have a powerful effect on people. Now, I have a feeling, though, it can't come from the outside. Unlike Ein Kovish Matar Asurim Beis HaAsurim, it's interesting. If you look at the Gemara on Ein Kovish Matar Asurim Beis HaAsurim, I forget who the Amoram, who were the Amoram there again? It was it Rav Yosef? It was, again, who was it? Whoever it was, right? They're literally lending their hands and pulling the person up in terms of the refuah. And the Gemara tells us that each was able to cure the other couldn't cure themselves. You're doing that. You're literally lifting them up. But the Yeshua is almost not direct. I think that what has to come from inside of them has to be from inside out, not from outside in. So to the extent that you could do that, it would be better. So, but to know, I think, could be helpful because it'll help you understand them a little bit better. I may not be right. I'm sort of making this up. Everybody, thank you so much. Sorry to have to run. And continue doing the wonderful work that you're doing.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.